Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Jordan is Nicholas Herrer, who is an analyst with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Jamestown Foundation, and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal, Fair Observer. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in the Jamestown Foundation's publications, among other publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Herrer.
Thank you for having me.
And there has been, of course, the bombing of the Iranian embassy in Lebanon, in Beirut. Already the Iran's foreign minister has blamed Israel for the attack, but the Syrian government statement blames Saudi Arabia, quoting, "Each of the terrorist attacks that strikes in Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq reek of petrodollars." It's pretty clear what they're saying there. So just to start with this, I know we're going to be talking about the Kurdish region and the war within a war that's going on amongst the rebels in northern Syria. This seems to be like the southern front. I mean, this is an extremely complicated mosaic, is it not?
Yes, it is. The attacks today on the Iranian embassy are probably the most blatant statement by forces against the al-Assad regime and its allies, Iran and Hezbollah, that has occurred since the bombings over the summer in the southern Beiruti suburbs of Dahiya, a traditional Hezbollah stronghold where many of the party's constituents live. Soon after the attacks, a Sunni Islamist armed opposition group, which claims to be based in Lebanon, the Abdullah Azzam Brigade, stated it had made the attack in order to force Hezbollah to withdraw its fighters from Syria, which have been fighting in support of the al-Assad government. These attacks are again aimed at areas that are considered core support for al-Assad, but how much impact they'll actually have on the fighting on the ground in Syria is questionable. Right now, Hezbollah is reported to be assisting the Syrian army in many key strategic areas of the fighting in Syria, particularly a range of mountains and badlands north and northwest of Damascus called the Jabal Kalamun. And the importance of this area is that it lies on the strategic M5 highway, which connects Damascus, still the capital of the al-Assad government, to its core areas of support in the western governorates of Syria, such as Homs and Latakia and Tartus governorates, where a majority of the Alawite minority support lives for the al-Assad government.
And I was just going to mention, Nicholas Herrer, that the Iranian cultural attaché at the embassy in Beirut, Sheikh Ibrahim Ansari, apparently is among the dead. But the point that you're making is, I guess, that the al-Assad regime, with the help of Hezbollah, are rolling back a lot of the gains of the rebels and more isolating the rebel enclave in the Damascus suburbs.
Yes, and in fact, the reason, part of the motivation for this attack on the Jabal Kalamun area has been in order to do exactly that, is to isolate some of the more formed opposition groups, particularly the Islamist Liwa al-Islam and its sometimes allies, the Al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra, and other groups such as the militant Salafist armed opposition group Ahrar al-Sham, from being able to strike at the M5 highway, which has been a target for the Syrian armed opposition groups since at least last summer. The fighting in the Syrian town of Al-Qusayr, which concluded in June, which was at the time considered the most highly strategic town, which lied near the M5 highway, which ended in a victory for Hezbollah, it's in the Syrian military, and militias drawn up under the National Defense Army, which are local defense units that, if not in support of the al-Assad government, are at least tolerant of the regime and are fearful of the alternative being on the armed Islamist opposition groups. And this offensive, which has been described as being in a slow burn, is now seems to be flaring up. And the result has been a large number of refugees from Syria coming into Lebanon. Some recent figures suggest that you have upwards of 18 to 30,000 refugees that have fled into Lebanon from the area of Jabal Kalamun over the weekend. And the fight in that area in many ways is an existential battle for the armed opposition. It has been trying unsuccessfully for over a year now to cut off Damascus from what is considered the core heartland of the Syrian government support. And it blames Hezbollah, which many Hezbollah-controlled areas are contiguous with this region of Syria, for extending the life of the al-Assad government.
So just in the last minute or so then, Nicholas Herrer, my understanding is that the Assad regime has actually gone after the more secular groups, the more Free Syrian Army groups with greater firepower, and haven't pursued the Salafist groups quite as zealously, because the Salafists, Saudi-backed, Qatari-backed, and frankly, I find it very hard to understand how Saudi Arabia, that is a very tightly run country with a very strong secret police and religious police as well, why they continually say, well, I'm sorry, we can't stop the flow of money. This is just private money. This is not official state money. It seems very inconsistent that the state, such a tightly run state, can't control the outflow of money. But that aside, it seems that the whole idea of these Salafist groups and their backing from Saudi and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf has played right into Assad's hands.
Yes, it has. And it's also, and it's an important, that's an important point to raise, because one of the most powerful armed opposition groups in Damascus, the capital, Liwa al-Islam, which is the focus of the current Syrian military and Hezbollah offensive in that area, the Jabal al-Mun, north of Damascus, has reports of having strong ties with Saudi intelligence. And some estimate that it's received millions of dollars in financial assistance from the Saudi government and Saudi intelligence. And this is this axis, the Syrian government under Bashar al-Assad and Hezbollah under Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, consistently made this point throughout the conflict. They've created a narrative of resistance. And their narrative of resistance, which before had been part of an axis of resistance with Iran and at one point Hamas and other concerned parties, had always been aimed towards Israel, towards confronting Israel, towards hope winning one day, winning back Jerusalem and all the way into Palestine and forcing back the Israeli foe, has now shifted to a new narrative of resistance. And this narrative of resistance isn't necessarily new. Bashar's father, Hafez al-Assad, during what some could argue credibly was an actual civil war from 1976 to 1982, where the militant Salafist Fighting Vanguard group actively waged attacks against the Syrian military, which is military, and also members of the Ba'ath Party that it perceived to be part of a corrupt Alawite-dominated government, the precursor in many ways to Arab fighters that would go and join Osama bin Laden's movement in Afghanistan, and then the precursor to all these hardcore militant Salafist movements that we see now today in Syria as history turns again. This narrative of resistance has been cultivated by Bashar al-Assad, a reinvention of his father's narrative of resistance, which has been added to Hezbollah's narrative of resistance, now focuses on these militant Salafist groups and aligns them as the main dagger being wielded by a conspiracy of Gulf Arab, Sunni and Gulf Arab monarchy states, the United States and the West writ large, and Israel, in order to defeat the axis of resistance and to weaken or destroy their ability to confront Israel and to confront what they implied, the government of Bashar al-Assad, Hezbollah and the Islamic Republic of Iran, as imperialism. And this is an important point, because going along with sectarian community fears, the fears of communities such as Christians, the fears of some Sunnis who do not trust the more hardline elements in the armed opposition, other communities such as the Druze and the Alawites, the minority Alawite community, which the al-Assad regime draws Tartar core support. These fears very neatly neatly go along with this renewed sense and this renewed message of resistance narrative against a foreign conspiracy wielding militant jihadism to destroy what had been a secular Syrian regime.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Nicholas Harrow. We haven't even got to the even further complication of what's happening in the Kurdish area of Syria, which is similar to what happened in Iraq 10 years ago, where the Kurds sense an opportunity to right old wrongs and reverse the Arabization and, of course, seize the oil reserves. This has even prompted the Barzani, the head of the Kurdish autonomous area of northern Iraq, to accuse the Syrian Kurdish group PYD of being in league with Assad to wreck a golden opportunity for Kurdish unity in Syria. So that is a further complication we don't have time to discuss. But I really appreciate you joining us here today from Jordan, Nicholas Herra.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Herra, who is an analyst with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Jamestown Foundation, and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in the Jamestown Foundation's publications, among other publications, and he joined us from Jordan. This has been a special retrospective of Background Briefing from 2013. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down in a minute.